The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi everyone, I'm Jim Poplava and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income, a special program because May is the month of graduation. And if you're a parent thinking about those expensive college bills coming ahead, this is a program designed especially for you.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest on this topic for the program today is Rob Franek. He is Senior Vice President and Publisher of the Princeton Review. We are going to talk about the best 379 colleges. Which are the colleges that actually pay you back, meaning the amount of money you're going to put into the education versus what you anticipate getting back out of it? I mean, this is a straight business deal, right? And the real question is, do all of the name colleges do better than or worse than some of the other colleges where you may spend a little less money? And speaking of colleges, if you're a parent with children who just graduated or will soon graduate. My youngest is going to get his PhD in about 3 months. It's the end of 12 years of this. So I know what it feels like, Jim. He's the last of three. And if he'd ever finish his doctoral dissertation.
12 years?
Yeah, 12 years.
Wow.
He carried extra degrees early on and took extra courses and everything like that. So it's like, yeah, it's over. There is life after college. Anyway, so if you're in that situation and your kids are going to graduate or they're right here because this is the month when they do it, usually in the beginning of June, you're probably thinking about or making plans for college for your kids. Now, that's in high school, right? You're thinking about college plans and you're wrestling with what college to choose. What are the costs going to be? Can you afford to send your kids to the best schools? Will they have a job when they graduate? All these are really very, very important questions, despite that I'm ratcheting through them here rather jocularly. But we need to look at that today, because today college, unlike when you and I were in college, Jim, I worked my way through college for the most part. I only had one $10,000 loan when I got out, and that was easily paid off at the time. And the rest of it, I worked at a classical radio station in the evening doing a classical radio show. And between cuts of Beethoven and Mozart, I could study and do work. So it worked out pretty well.
I did the same thing, John. And one of the solutions we're going to recommend is something I actually did for myself and all three of my sons. But, you know, like you, John, I worked, took 15 hours a semester. And I had my own little business at the time. I ran a parking concession for several restaurants. And I was lucky that the restaurant had this nice portico chair with a nice light they installed there so that, you know, I could do my studying at night in between parking cars. You'd get this rush around dinner time. After the dinner time rush, I'd sit out there and I'd do my homework and do my studying. So it was quite an experience. And I was fortunate enough that I didn't have any student loans. And then when I got out, well, I take that back. I had, when I went to Arizona State, I had a small student loan. But when I went on to graduate school, I was fortunate enough to have two scholarships. So I was one of the fortunate few that got out of school without a lot of student loans or a lot of debt. So, but if you are a student, you may be thinking about the things we're talking about here, the cost of that education and, you know, the amount of debt that you will amass. And according to latest statistics, the average married couple brings between $70,000 and $100,000 into a marriage. But it's not just the education. And more importantly, are you going to have a job when you graduate from college? So, you know, you not only have to pick the right college, you have to think about the cost of that education, what are going to be the prospects for work when you get out of school, and the salary that you're going to earn in your profession. So it's not just a concern for parents, but the students as well. When nationally, most students leave college, and this is just the median amount of debt, is about $30,000. Now, that was as of 2014. About 70% of graduates left college with close to $30,000 of debt. That is an average. That doesn't take into consideration those students that go to private school or go out of state that may have much more.
Yeah, and I think we've been fortunate enough to do it for about $15,000 in debt. If I looked at all of our kids, probably no more than $25,000 across three kids. And of course, I, with a Cheshire Cat grin, I always hand them the statement and say, now it's time for you to pay. You know, after they get out.
Well, you don't have much debt, but you do have some debt called mom and dad.
Well, yeah, there's some truth. I am keeping a running spreadsheet on that too. And yes, it is somewhat substantial, but we'll deal with that later. So anyway, are we going to address these issues on today's program? I mean, because I think when you're going to college, there are good degrees to get out of colleges. There are worthless degrees to get out of college. But you have to look at where the jobs are. How are you going to connect with that? What your prospects are as you go into your field. After you graduate, what will the field look like out there? And after all you spend, the equivalent of a small fortune getting educated, you want to make sure one way or another you get a job when you graduate so you can pay some of that back and make the whole thing worthwhile. That was the theory. Remember back in the 60s and 70s, if you just had a bachelor's degree, it was considered really something that gave you a step up. But then it moved up to master's degrees and then doctor's degrees. And now, even if you have a PhD, you have to move into postdoc programs. So the bar keeps going higher. The expenses keep going higher. I'm not sure the returns are going higher, though, Jim.
No, and we're going to discuss that with our guest today, Rob Franek, about the cost of college education. Are those A schools where you're going to spend, you know, $260,000, $280,000 or $200,000 minimum, are they really worth it? Because there are a number of stats also, John, on the job market, what to look at, both in demand, educational requirements, and starting salary ranges. One study listed the top 25 jobs in demand and the fastest growing occupations. No surprise, many of these jobs are in the medical field. In fact, 14 out of the 25 top jobs were in medical field. And it's everything from diagnostic, medical sonographers, physician assistants, physical therapists, occupational therapists, nurse practitioner. I know my youngest son is going back to school. He's going to get a master's degree going into occupational therapy. And there's a big demand on that. And it's no surprise, we are a country where we have the largest segment of the population, the largest retirement population in the history of the country, the baby boomers, are heading into retirement. And we all know what happens when we get older. We need more medical assistance. So it's not surprising that the top jobs are in the medical field. Now, one aspect of these reports really struck me. Many of the jobs, John, as you talk about, require higher education. And it was, you know, after World War II, you went out, and let's say you got out of high school and you got a bachelor's degree. That pretty much did it for you. It really opened up the job market. But today, most of these jobs and these top paying jobs where the greatest demand are, John, require a master's degree or, like in the case of your son, a PhD. So it's not just a bachelor's degree anymore. It's postgraduate work or postdoctoral work.
Yeah, it's interesting when you actually look at that, at how high it actually goes. And considering also that, you know, you've mentioned manufacturing is changing here in this country. And so you'll have a fewer number of highly robotized machines putting together whatever we put together rather than an army of workers. And the ones who do operate the machines are going to have to be higher skilled. The question is, what are the rest of the people going to do given where we're headed? So all of these things are factoring into the economy. Now, besides the medical field, which is where you do need a lot of preparation. I was watching a doctor who was shadowing my doctor this last week, and I thought, jeepers, the things these guys have to go through to get an MD. It hasn't become any less hellish. But what other professions stand out in terms of demand?
It was pretty widely dispersed from interpreters, translators, information systems, because, you know, we are a technologically driven society today. And especially, you know, you take a look at manufacturing. One of the things that has surprised a lot of the economists is manufacturing is at its highest level with fewer workers. And that's because a lot of this is being automated today, where you're finding factory floors are now being run with technicians operating robots. So most of these jobs were technical and scientific, requiring not only higher education, science, medical backgrounds. John, you're just not seeing much in liberal arts. So if you go out and you become an English major, good luck trying to get a job if you can get a job into teaching if there's a demand there. So a lot of technical jobs, manufacturing and medical, engineers, I don't care, any kind of engineer, electrical engineer, aeronautical engineer, industrial, huge, huge demand for engineering students today.
Now, what about pay scales? You know, one thing is demand, the other is pay scales and starting salaries. What fields are you going to find the top starting salaries?
You know, once again, right where the big demand is, medical and technical, not unusual to find, you know, starting salaries, 60, 70, 80,000, some are six figures. And you take a look at this, and we don't have, you know, time to cover all these jobs on the program, but medical technology and engineering. So anything in computer programming is still right up there. Anything in the medical field, there's going to be a huge demand there in engineering. Those are three that really stand out. They're all technical, all very scientific oriented. So they really stand out and the pay is right there. In fact, you know, you go to some of these top engineering schools, you know, you're getting job offers your senior year. I mean, you know, think about that. In your senior year, getting a job offer rather than graduating from college and saying, all right, I've got all this debt. I now have this degree and, you know, there's nothing on the prospects. I don't know what it was like for you, but I got my master's in international management from Thunderbird, John. And, you know, I had three or four job offers my last semester in graduate school. You know, that was really comforting because we just got married and we were starting a family to know that, you know, as soon as I got out, I had my choice or pick of two or three job offers. And so that's something that you're really going to want to take a look at and just understand we live in this highly complex, technologically driven society today. And it's no surprise that's where the best jobs are. That's where the best pay is. But it also requires special skill set when it comes to an education.
Over the last two decades, you know, we've seen top jobs in technology and on Wall Street, but now we have an aging population and a bigger demand for medical care, even as we're going into a problematical situation with the availability of it. So medical care can be added to that list. What is really clear is that if you go into any kind of liberal arts, sociology, history, especially ethnic studies, the job prospects outside of academia are extremely limited. That's almost an academic degree that has to be used with inside of academia with very little practical application outside. So what's becoming clear before that you fork over a fortune in education expense, including living expenses and moving, you know where the jobs are, what you can expect in starting salaries to start off your career to pay off those loans, especially if, you know, I'm flabbergasted at some of the loan amounts that I've heard people run up.
Oh, it's incredible, especially if you go on to an A-rated school, or it doesn't even have to be an A-rated school. What if you go to an out-of-state school where the tuition is going to be much greater, and of course, you're going to have room and board on top of that. What is really becoming clear is a bachelor's degree is no longer a fast track to a big paycheck that they once were. But certain professions still have a significant head start in the years immediately following graduation. You always hear about law school and medical school, but certain professions still stand out. Investment bankers, roughly the average median pay, $112,000, 9% growth rate. Software developer, $84,000 with a 30% growth rate. Actuaries, those are people who work for like insurance companies, roughly $79,000, a 21% growth rate. Engineers, $72,000 with 11% growth rate. Now, this is just with a bachelor's degree. And network systems administrator, $70,000, 23% growth rate. So you can see there, John, there are certain professions, mainly engineering and investment banker and technology. The three professions that we're talking about where your starting pay could be $70,000, $80,000, or in the case of investment banker, six figures a year as a starting salary. Not bad for coming out of college. And especially if you can do that with minimal debt.
You know, I think the common link we're seeing here is scientific or technology specific rather than general. So, I mean, if we sum it up, the top three or four professions are going to be technology, medical, engineering, or finances. Now, what about, we hear about the disparities between pay and rewards between men and women. How does that stack?
You know, I think Forbes just did a study on the top jobs for women. Sales engineer, $134,000 a year. Math and science, $129,000. Astronomer, physicist, $119,000. Nurse, anesthetist, $114,000. And check this out. Petroleum engineer, $105,000. So once again, more towards specialty, scientific. Of course, any other top jobs, whether it's technology, engineering, or medical, finance, all hold true as well for women as well as men. These four fields clearly are where the jobs are with the greatest demand, the top salaries, and the highest prospects for growth.
All right, now that we've discussed the top jobs where the demand and the pay tends to rest, let's move on to education. The best colleges, the cost of getting a degree to get those jobs, and some of the pluses and minuses.
Money just released their top report of the best colleges for 2015. The price of an education, the average cost with college aid, and student debt upon graduation. Now, listeners, prepare yourself. The costs were a shock to me as well. I always thought, John, maybe $40,000, $50,000, but actually it could be much higher than that. The number one college, Stanford University, you know, John, can run as high as $60,000. Princeton, Caltech, Harvard. You know, I saw a figure, and I think this is reflective of 2015, $260,000 for a degree at Harvard. So, you know, you get into Princeton, Yale, Harvard, MIT, University of Chicago, John, you're talking $250,000 for room and board and tuition for basically a four-year degree. Imagine if you go on and get an MBA, or think if you went to medical school like Dr. Ben Carson at Harvard, imagine what that is going to cost. So it is surprising, but the average range for these top schools was anywhere from $250,000 to $280,000. So the average yearly cost is much higher than the national average. That's a problem when you have national averages. You take the schools that people really want to get into, and, you know, John, it's more like $60,000 to $70,000 a year.
Okay, well, you either have lots of bucks or you get a scholarship and or a decent loan or some other kind of aid. Sometimes there are contributing employment that you can get depending on the field that you're in, such as student teaching, and you combine all of this stuff. Now, when you look at tuition fees, what about schools here and move to form some kind of a budget? Because if you have the right degree, I suspect you still have a great chance of getting that job and the salary. So let's look at college costs that what are more practical in light of what it is you're going to get in terms of an occupation.
I had a long list I was going to do with this, but I'm going to cover more of this with Rob Franek because he's got 20 schools that are not on the A list, where you can get almost a similar education and stature in terms of jobs. But, you know, some of the top schools are Texas A&M, University of Washington, Virginia Polytechnic, Martin Luther, Fairfield, Mass Maritime Academy. And Money did a top study on the top 50 colleges. You know, 66% acceptance rate. Some will accept B students. And, you know, you can get that cost down to maybe $20,000, $25,000 a year, which, you know, maybe if you're lucky, you can get a four-year degree for between $80,000 and $100,000. We're going to talk here in a moment a cheaper way to do that. But it is absolutely surprising and astounding that if you really do your homework, and if you're a parent out there and a student listening to this, you don't have to go to Stanford or Harvard. There are plenty of great engineering schools, schools for medical, schools for finance, like the University of Berkeley, California. I mean, there are a number of schools out there that are not going to cost you, you know, the equivalent of buying a home just to get a four-year degree.
So if we sum up everything we've discussed to this point in the conversation, some things become rather clear rather quickly before you head off to college. Number one, you want to look at where the greatest job prospects are, because ultimately you're going to be able to get the job when you graduate. You want to get the job. So the first step in this process is to research where the greatest demand for high-paying jobs are, and then decide the field most interesting to you. You know, a lot of people, Jim, I'm sure have locked themselves into fields they absolutely positively can't stand and 20 years later wonder what they're doing, then decide that you should pursue that. After that, look at colleges that are affordable, because you don't want a mountain of debt when you graduate from college. It just shackles you down based on where it is you need to go with the rest of your life, which is really the reason you work. You know, as I always say, we work to live. We don't live to work. You got to make sure which way you got the priorities set here.
You know, a couple of things that you really want to prioritize here. You not only want to look at where the jobs are, because let's face it, you're going to spend a fortune on an education. You want to make sure when you get out of that school or college that, you know, you're going to have a job waiting for you. So you want to find a field where you have an interest in, because, you know, if you don't like medical, you don't like finance, you don't like computer programming, you don't like engineering, I mean, you don't want to go into a field that you don't have an interest in, because you're probably not going to excel at it. So then once you find the profession that you think you want to go into, and this is why I'm in favor of what I call work experience, then you find the best affordable college to equip you for getting that job. Now, I've always been a proponent of what I call the 2+2 program, and that is 2 years of a junior college and then 2 years at a state college. And if you think about it, if, you know, that's what I did, John. I went to Phoenix College and then I went to Arizona State. My degree from Arizona State doesn't say half Arizona State, it says Arizona State. And you think about the first 2 years of school, you're taking your standard required curriculum, you know, English 101, math, biology. You know, you can get a good education at a junior college for about $2,500, at least that's what they're here in California. And if you're living at home, you can also be working. So now you're getting work experience, but the college cost is only $2,500, which is affordable for not only you if you're working or your parents. And then you transfer to, let's say, a university in the state that you live in, hopefully even one close by, so you could actually stay at home and not run up all that, you know, room and board cost that can be expensive as well. And so you can bring down that cost. You figure $2,500 a year at a junior college, so you got about $5,000-$6,000 there, and then maybe $15,000 to $20,000 for a state university. And John, you can get that cost to $40,000 to $50,000. And I'm also another big believer, as we talked last week, alternative work and online degrees. So you not only have work experience, but you also find out you like the field, and more importantly, you graduate with no or little debt. Imagine starting out of college, at least that's the way it was for my wife and I. When I got out of graduate school, you know, I had very little student debt from undergraduate degree, and my graduate school was paid for with scholarships. So I was able to start a family, buy a home, because I didn't have any debt. And this is where I think the paradigm shift has got to come, because there's just way too much debt that's out there that saddles a lot of these young couples starting out in life. And you really need to gain some experience in the field. And more importantly, you graduate with no debt when you come out. So the education paradigm, John, that existed for almost half a century is not working. You got to figure out the least costly education to get that job, and that leaves you with the least amount of debt when you graduate. But the days of just going into debt, not looking at job prospects, John, that's no longer working. And one of the big issues is financing this massive student loans. It's not only a big burden on parents, but it's also a big burden on students, many of which don't have good prospects to pay them off.
Well, that's true. So if you're going to do this in the right order, number one, you need to research which jobs are paying well out there. Get some work experience, as a matter of fact. That's really, really important while you're in college. If you can be involved in the industry which you anticipate entering, and this would, of course, be at an entry level, but it already gives you a foot in the door. And I know in my business in broadcasting, just getting in that door was really important to begin a series of careers, because it's almost a cyclical loop. You get into broadcasting based on who you know, but you don't know anybody till you get in. And so that's sort of hard, but the work experience does begin to build. And the next one, evaluate the cost of your education versus what you expect to get out of your job in the future as being the most affordable. So, you know, don't spend more on education than you're really going to see yielded in the immediate future from the job you're going to get. And what you want to look at is alternative options to minimize the cost, the debt, and everything that would drag with you as you go into the workplace after graduating. Then target the outcome that you want to achieve. Get the job that you want, the salary you deserve, and the education you can afford. It's just a framework. It's a plan for evaluating what it is you want to do in life. Now, it's time to discuss this week's case study, as with all of our case studies here on the program. These are real life people. We just changed their names to protect their privacy. And this week we have Joe and Kathy Simpson. They had a very, very bright daughter and prospects of acceptance to a top school. How did that work? I mean, we have a case study here we want to illustrate that addresses this issue with parents that had a bright daughter. They knew where they wanted to put her, to a top private school where costs were well beyond what parents could usually afford. So what really happened in this drama, Jim?
You know, this is something that probably faces a lot of students today. And not only that, parents. Imagine if you're a parent, your kid is top-notch, and can get accepted to some of the top schools in the country. And all of a sudden, you're faced with looking at the cost of that education. And that's what we're going to discuss, because in this case, Joe and Kathy Simpson, Joe was an engineer at Qualcomm, Kathy was a dental hygienist. This was a second marriage for Joe and Kathy. Kathy had two children from her previous marriage and one with her marriage with Joe. The oldest daughter, Jennifer, had extremely high SAT scores and a 4.0 grade average. She was accepted to USC at a cost of $50,000 a year. Here's the problem. They only had roughly about $30,000 that were saved up, and that was mainly gifts from Kathy's parents. Now, here's the thing that just didn't make sense. Jennifer really wanted to be a teacher. She loved kids. But here's the problem, John. That $200,000 education was only going to yield her a $40,000 job starting out as a teacher versus $200,000 in educational cost. And the problem was they had three children, all of them doing well in school. So if you spend $200,000 on one kid, what are you going to tell the other two? Now, looking at their finances, they had a home worth roughly about $900,000, $500,000 mortgage. Joe's 401k was worth about $600,000. He also had $100,000 of company stock. Kathy's 401k was worth about $90,000. Between them, they had $40,000 in IRAs. They had roughly about $20,000 in savings. So what were the options? Number one, get a second mortgage on the house because they did have a lot of equity. Jennifer to apply for student loans, or something that I suggested in the course of the plan was our 2+2 plan, where basically Jennifer would stay at home, go to junior college, and then eventually go to either University of San Diego or UCLA, where it would cost $20,000 because they had $30,000 saved up already, so they could almost cover that four-year degree. And it took a session, actually, where I had to meet with Jennifer and say, look, you got a brother and another sister. If your parents spent $200,000, the reality is you want to be a teacher. Starting salary for you as a teacher is not going to make a difference if you go to USC or UCLA or a junior college with 2 years at UCLA. And, you know, do you really want to start your career as a teacher with $100,000 worth of debt? And your parents can't do that. You really want your parents to go into debt and mortgage the house. So, you know, one of the options was basically take a $150,000 line of credit on the home. And here's the problem. You know, Joe's facing retirement in about 12 years. Did he really want to take and jeopardize his retirement by taking on additional debt? So, you know, we met with the daughter, explained the idea of $40,000. And I also said, look, you know, someday you're going to want to get married. How attractive is it going to be to your prospective husband if you say, hey, by the way, I've got $100,000 plus in student loans? So we looked at options one and two. And the other thing that I pointed out to her is I go, look, what is going to make the difference for you advancing your profession as a teacher? And she said, well, a master's degree. I said, a master's degree would be much more affordable. You could start with 2 years at a junior college, stay at home, go away for 2 years, get your degree, and then as you begin teaching, then you can go to an online school and get your master's degree and pay for that with the earnings that you're going to get as a teacher versus racking up all this debt going to a top-notch school. And, you know, this was something that we faced with in our own family. I believed in this 2+2 program because this is what we did with all three of our sons, even though I could afford to send my kids to school. And my oldest son was valedictorian of his graduating class, but he didn't know what he wanted to do when he got out of school. So, I mean, he could have got into an A-rated school if he wanted to. As a valedictorian, he had the GPA for it, but he went for a junior college. We made all our kids work, and he worked in the business with me. And, you know, at 18, he got his brokerage license and fell in love with the financial field. So it was a result of work experience that determined his career that came through work. And it was something that I did with all three of my sons. My middle son, the same thing. He had internships during the summer with a veterinarian because at one time he wanted to be a vet. And then in the research department at Pfizer in their drug research program, and didn't actually ended up in this field. But, you know, it is such a better paradigm. And Jennifer, when we went over the numbers, I said, look, here's the choice. Your parents simply can't afford to take out a second mortgage on the house with you. It's not going to be fair to your other sister and your brother. And secondly, you know, the reality is, as a teacher, you know, USC is not going to get you a higher paid job than if you went to a regular, let's say, UCLA. I mean, there's not going to be a big difference there. And wouldn't it be better off starting out at $40,000 a year? So in the end, John, this was a program that she agreed, you know, looking at the finances, and this was a very close family. She loved her parents. Parents loved her. And she realized, hey, yeah, dad is 12 years away from retirement. I'm not going to want him saddled with a huge mortgage payment because it put me through school. And she realized, you know, neither did she want to end up with a situation. And I go, look, you're smart enough with grades. You can still apply for a work program at college that you work for part of that tuition in, let's say if she went to UCLA to get her final 2 years of her bachelor's degree, so she could actually even apply that. So there are a number of things that she could have done, and in the end, she chose the wise course, decided to stay at home, actually was working at Nordstrom's, making some good money, and going to a junior college, John. So it just made a lot more sense for the Simpsons not to get into debt, to send one bright kid to, let's say, an A-rated school and save on the money. Because after all, as I pointed out to the Simpsons, I go, you know, you got three kids to get through college. It's not just Jennifer. You know, one of the interesting things about this next interview, John, is in the financial world, when we're looking at companies, there's a term called ROIC, return on invested capital, which is the rage now for analyzing companies. This same ROIC is now being applied to college education and job prospects. It's called return on investment in college. So it's amazing, but it changes the whole dynamic when you're looking at a college education is, what is it going to cost me? And is it worth that extra $100,000 in terms of pay, starting pay, or job prospects when you get out? Because, you know, these days, when you're taking a look at a top-notch school running $60,000 to $70,000, $250,000 to $280,000 for a four-year degree, you really do have to look at the amount of money you're going to expend, and then also what the prospects are.
So I guess the summary there is, number one, you should have a plan. That seems to be the root of everything else. It's like a Navy SEAL. Have a plan. Beyond that, have a backup plan and have a backup to the backup. But start early in the whole planning for this type of thing. Make the right investments to generate those things that you need to have in order to support the college education. And that involves tax minimization and other things like that. So here's what you did. You looked at the cost of the education, the job prospects related to that education, trying to make those things match, and then minimizing any of the costs that are associated, that includes debt, with the education designed to get you to the job. And we're going to examine those colleges which have the biggest bang for the buck, so to speak, the A versus the B colleges. Are the B educations any worse than the A educations necessarily, where the education cost is a lot lower? Rob Pronick will join us, Senior Vice President and Publisher of the Princeton Review, as Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, we all know the cost of education has been going up every single year. Over long periods of time, the cost of education has exceeded the CPI and the cost of living. But it gets even more expensive when you're considering a private education, or what we call the A schools. Is it really worth the extra $100,000 to $150,000? Joining us on the program as my special guest is Rob Pronick. He's Senior Vice President and Publisher of the Princeton Review. Rob, I want to begin with, you know, what the numbers are today. I hear that a private education like Harvard or Stanford can cost as much, with room and board, as much as $60,000, $70,000 a year. A private four-year degree could run in the neighborhood of anywhere from over $200,000 to as much as $280,000. Can you bring us up to date? What does it cost to go to a top 10 school like a Harvard or Stanford, you know, MIT? What does that run today?
I'm totally hearing the question, and it's one that comes up often from students, you know, coming into our Princeton Review channel. The numbers that we talk about, and we call it, Jim, total cost of attendance. This is tuition, room and board, fees, and books. And the total cost of attendance for 1 year of private college or university, average nationally, is a little over $41,000. But you're very right. So many of the schools that our students and so many students and parents are considering now might top the $50,000, $55,000, $65,000, $68,000 NYU in my home city of New York City this year. So they become heart-stoppingly expensive. But I do want students and parents to take some minor solace, at least, to understand that $41,000 is the average cost of attendance for 1 year of private school. On the other side of the fence, total cost of attendance, again, tuition, room and board, fees, and books, for 1 year of public university this year, about $19,400. So we still know that other than buying a family home, college tuition is going to be the second, and in some cases, the most major expense that a family will take on. The good news, though, is that more than two-thirds of all students that are college-bound and in college now are actually paying the sticker cost, that total cost of attendance. They're offsetting that with financial aid, and this is free money, you know, merit-based grants, merit-based grant aid, certainly scholarship dollars that will bring those costs dramatically down, and then in some cases, students taking out loans.
When you're talking about right there, if we just stick with the average numbers, Rob, basically, let's just round it off and say $20,000 for, let's say, a state university, $40,000 for a private education. It's twice as expensive. So I guess the question that really comes up, because we're hearing all kinds of things like high unemployment rates with college graduates, is the extra money paying twice as much for the education, is that return on investment worth the additional dollars?
The way we discuss it at Princeton Review is students have to be able, college-bound students have to be able to find a best-fit college or university. And the way we define it is certainly academic fit. You want to be challenged in the classroom. Campus culture fit and lots of things fit into that bucket of what you're going to be doing outside the classroom. But the last two issues of fit are a financial aid fit and a career services fit. And I think it's that last part of career services that I think clearly answers your question. We talk about this Princeton Review and say, listen, let's break some taboos here and start talking about what is going to be the return on your investment. If you decide to pay for a school that's $68,000 a year annually, or a school that's $21,000 a year annually, what is the difference between school A and B? What are you getting for that difference in cost? And the truth is that it's not the same for every school. What we try to talk to students about is being smart during their college research when they are still in high school along with their parents and asking questions that were taboo just a few years ago, asking the question of ROI, asking the question of what the career service resources are that you're going to have access to, asking about alumni network and what that means for a current student, either through internships or jobs afterwards. So I do think that there are differences in schools. Even though those tuition costs are different, I think there are many differences in the services and the access that students can get because of the school that they're going to.
You know, I was told, at least when I was going to college and graduate school, I was told by my professor, one of the advantages of going to like an A school like a Harvard or a Stanford, you go to Harvard, you're going to be around people that you may later on in life have alumni that become the next Supreme Court justice, the president of the United States, or the CEO of a major corporation. So networking with those kind of people is another advantage of those A schools.
I just so appreciate that guidance. And in many ways, it is true in that if you're going to an Ivy League school or a school with a big brand, you will have a great brand and a great network of alum to access, honestly, for the rest of your adult life. And that is a very powerful lever. The thing that we've been talking about at Princeton Review is that it doesn't stop with Ivies. I have a new book that came out, and I'm one of the authors for it called Colleges That Pay You Back, and it came out in February. One of the ranking lists that we do, and there's substantive narrative in the book, and it's all available up on PrinceReview.com, which is our website, but we do seven different ranking lists in that book, one of which is Best Alumni Network. And just number four in that list, Claremont McKenna College, which is part of the five Claremont colleges out in Pomona, California. Exceptional school, but only 1,800 students. But you can know also, you could take solace that, you know, a school like Claremont McKenna, which is an exceptional school, one of my personal favorites at Princeton Review, can still be a powerhouse school with a small student body with a powerful alumni network. So I caution students, or I challenge students and parents to think beyond brand and perceptual brand reputation and say that there's going to be best fits for you that can also be great ROI for you later on in life.
So two of the things that you look at when you're evaluating a college, it's not only career opportunities, but also the ability to offset those costs with financial aid. Now, you recently did a study on a number of colleges, and I think you boiled it down to among the 200 best colleges out there. And what were some of the criteria, and how did a school qualify to make it to your top list?
Well, I'm so appreciate you asking the question. And the end result of that book that I had referenced called Colleges That Pay You Back. And we started with just over 2,000 four-year colleges and universities to start in that universe of schools. And then we winnowed down that list to the final 200 that are in the book. They are divided near evenly between public and private universities as well. Specifically for the criteria in the book, we looked at basically three different buckets. We looked at what is that total cost of attendance. So what is the sticker cost, as we talked about before? Second bucket is how aggressively is that school making that school affordable for students? So what types of grants and scholarships are they giving out, not forcing a student to take out a loan? And then the third part is that bucket that we're just talking about. What are the career resources that are going to help me, not when I'm a second semester senior, but a first semester freshman? And this is such a powerful thing. And I'm curious to see if this was your experience when you're in school, but I didn't know about the Career Resource Center when I was a freshman or sophomore, or probably even a junior in college. I found out about it when I knew how to get a job later on. But schools are so gloriously different now, or so many are so gloriously different, in that you are being introduced to the career resources, not even when you're a first semester freshman, but when you're a prospective student. And that changes the conversation. That changes the conversation for a student looking for a school and a parent helping them along the way with their guidance counselors, because now you can talk about ROI and you can talk about internships and co-ops and experiential learning and jobs afterwards or graduate school afterwards, but you can talk about that when you're still choosing what school is going to be the best fit for you.
You know, I know there's a lot of different forms of aid, and perhaps, Rob, you can address this. I know there's scholarships, there's merit, there's various low-financed aid packages, but there's also work programs. So you work at the college and offset some of those costs.
The easiest way to understand financial aid, and it is a bear of a process, but when I talk to students and parents, I tell students, listen, and these are high school students, your job is to be awesome in high school. Your job is to do superlatively on the SAT and the ACT. That is your job, because those are going to do two things for you. One, hopefully secure you admission to the many schools that are making it onto your list that you'll actually apply to. And number two, it can qualify students for scholarship dollars from those schools. Basically, academic merit-based scholarships, money you do not have to pay back because of your performance in high school and on standardized tests. When I talk to parents in those same audiences, I tell them their job is singular, and that is to be fearless around the financial aid process. And coupling those two things together, hopefully we're creating very confident college shoppers. Because the financial aid process, I mean, we call it financial aid, but it is, as you say, both a mixture of scholarships, grants, merit-based money they don't have to pay back, and then some loans, some work study programs and things like that. The biggest thing that a student can remember and a parent is that other than their college application being the primary of importance next year or the next couple of years, the financial aid application, and there's an acronym that it stands for, FAFSA, which is the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. That is the grail for college financial aid applications, and it will qualify students and parents to get that aid. There are some additional financial aid forms for a certain number of schools, one's called a CSS profile, but the primary driver is going to be that FAFSA form, and that will qualify students for need-based aid based on family need. It will also qualify them for loans based on the things that you were talking about, work-study programs, other than the Stafford loans and things like that that a student might want to take out or work for part of their college tuition. And the biggest bucket that students can help pull on is a 40% bucket. And that 40% bucket doesn't come from the aid from the FAFSA form based on need. The 40% bucket will come based on their academic performance and performance on SAT and ACT. I can't underscore this point enough because students have an active job in this process, and that is to be great in school and to do well on standardized tests because it qualifies them for academic admission and scholarship dollars for the majority of the 4,000 schools out there.
Rob, let me ask you, and I don't know how applicable this is to a private college, but a lot of in-state schools will take students from, let's say, a junior college. So you go to a junior college here in California, might cost you $2,500 a year. You take, you know, all your undergraduate required courses like English 101 and 102 and basic general courses and then transfer to, let's say, a state school. Now, you know, that's what I did because I had to work my way through college. I went to a junior college. It's hard to believe I paid $45 a semester, so I don't want to give away my age. Yeah. But when I transferred to Arizona State, when I was going to a junior college, I got in touch with a counselor that told me these are the courses that will transfer to Arizona State. But when I graduated with Arizona State, my degree said Arizona State. It didn't say one half Arizona State. Does that same thing apply to like an A school like a Harvard or a Stanford? Or do they only take beginning students from freshman year on?
That path to a four-year degree, to a bachelor's degree, absolutely is viable for students today. Starting at an associate's degree granting school, a two-year college, junior college, you know, associate's degree school, call what you will, and then moving on to a four-year school. You can certainly transfer in to any school in the country, including the most superlative, the most academically challenging to get into. The problem is that so many students want to go to those schools as well, both as a first-time freshman as well as for a transfer student. So I'm reluctant to say that there's a, let's say, a backdoor way for a student to get into some of the most competitive schools in the country by being a transfer student. It is certainly a viable route for students, but the population is small that goes in as a transfer student. But there are schools like Arizona State University, of which I am a big fan of both Michael Crow, their current president, as well as many other large state schools and smaller privates as well, that welcome in transfer students. Because the truth is that there are always going to be students that are churning through the process. Some will move on to an additional school and we will fill their spots, you know, just through, you know, natural course of doing business. Students may, you know, transfer out of a school. So there'll always be a needed population coming in as a transfer student. And, as you cite, there is great value to that from a student from a pocketbook wallet perspective, and that is a fine, fine route. The only detractor, well, there are two quick detractors. Sometimes an associate's degree granting community school is not right for every student. So I go back to what we were talking about before. Students have to be able to sensibly say, this is a best fit school for me, and to make that decision without hesitation. The other part, transferring into a four-year college, is that generally speaking, the scholarships that you'll get for those last 2 years of time will be far less than a student would get as a first-time freshman, simply because you're going to be spending 2 years there instead of 4 years. But, you know, you can still make a dramatic savings, as you were saying, for those first 2 years at a community school or 2-year granting school, whatever it might be, and make up that savings later on.
So when you take a look at bringing down the cost, I think you said almost two-thirds of college students receive some form of financial aid, because even state schools today, when you're talking about $20,000 for a room, book, tuition, all of that can add up. And if, you know, you're a parent and you have two or three kids, you're talking about a sizable amount of money over a period of time. You came up with the top 20 colleges that pay you back, meaning that the money you're going to spend for the degree is well worth it when it comes to career choices and, let's say, opportunities after college. What was your selection process? How did you get onto that list?
That list is a subsidiary list from the 200 schools that made it into that same book. That's the same name as the ranking list. So the colleges that pay you back, we have 200 schools that, again, all superlative and doing great work, certainly providing an academic environment that's highly competitive, but then also providing students with great financial aid and then, you know, career services upon exit, or even when they're in school, but jobs upon exit. We culled out the top 50 most superlative out of that 200 list, and those are the schools that made it into the book. So the criteria is the same. It's those three buckets: one, exceptional academic experience; two, exceptional financial aid experience; and then three, exceptional career services, resources for undergraduates, and then once they graduate as well. The one other thing that we looked at and that we factored into all of those schools is looking at pay scale data. So where did students go after they graduated from college? And we followed, we partnered with payscale.com that does a lot of tracking of, you know, of students, of people as they're moving through their professional lives and finding out what disciplines they're in or what jobs they're in, what their academic discipline was as an undergraduate, did that, and did that propel them into the career that they are now? You know, what is their starting salary? Where are they now in their salary history? So trying to think about that longitudinal view was essential to coming up with that 50. Number one on the list this year is Caltech. I mean, average starting salaries for a Caltech student, probably not surprisingly, is, you know, are some of the highest in the country, well over $75,000, you know, for students coming in. And then Princeton, Cooper Union, again, here in New York where I am, Cooper Union for the Advancement of Sciences, Harvey Mudd, one of the other Pomonas that we talked about, number five on the list, not surprisingly, is MIT.
I see some of the A schools there, too. You're talking about Princeton, you're talking about MIT, Stanford, Yale, Brown, Columbia, Vanderbilt, although Amherst, University of Pennsylvania, Dartmouth, Duke, Cornell. So the A list makes up a good sizable portion of that top 20.
You're very right for pointing it out. There are those schools that are going to be A-list schools, some usual suspect schools that have great brand reputation. I mean, I underscore that these schools are not only great perceptual brands, but they are paying students back when we start to talk about, you know, college ROI. I do still love that we are extending that lens of schools, looking at the universe of schools, and then saying, you know what, Carleton College in, you know, Northfield, Minnesota also deserves great mention on that list. It's number 28 on the list of 50. You know, WashU and St. Louis, UCLA, Sportsmore, Pomona. I mean, these are all exceptional schools that should be in that same conversation as a Caltech or a Princeton.
Yeah, because you also had a list. You wrote an article called 13 Public Colleges with the Best ROI. And so let's talk about some of the list of public schools, because, you know, for most parents, that seems more affordable. Obviously, going to a public college could be a lot cheaper than going to Stanford or Harvard.
It will be, and it can be for some students. But when I talk to students and parents, one of the biggest mistakes that we've seen students and parents make, college-bound students and parents, at the Princeton Review, is crossing an expensive school off of their list of consideration early on just because of that sticker price. So if a school is charging, you know, let's look at Rice, you know, they're about $58,000 or $60,000 a year, but their average aid package for a student is well over $43,000 this year. So bringing that cost down to what we had talked about in the beginning part of our conversation, which was, you know, what is the average cost to attend 1 year of public university, which is just around $20,000 a year. So there are schools that might charge a high sticker price. Some of those same schools will have the deepest pockets financially, and they will say, okay, you know, Jim, you've demonstrated that you have financial need. I have financial need. They're going to meet our need, in some cases, 100%. And Rice is one of those schools that can say that. Princeton is another that can say, listen, we're going to meet a student and family's demonstrated need from the FAFSA form 100%. And that is something that most state schools, although lower in tuition costs, likely won't be able to do. So my challenge for students and parents is to communicate, to be as smart and savvy as possible around the selection of schools and being armed with financial aid data and the scholarship data, the average scholarships that students can get as they're making their decision of where they're going to apply and ultimately enroll.
I know there has been a movement. In fact, it was in the press this week that there is some movement by Congress to have some of these A-rated schools like Harvard, Yale, Princeton use some of their endowment funds to lower the cost of education or face possible taxation. Now, that was brought up this week in the Wall Street Journal. Is that a possibility? In other words, could you see that happening? And let's say to thwart such attempts by Congress, could you see more aggressive financial aid packages coming from these large schools?
It would be difficult for me to say that I'm going to see a credible rollback of tuition costs for the many, many schools that we write about. I do think that more and more schools are saying, you know, our costs are so high and we are causing such worry and stress in the college process for students and parents because of the specter of paying for college and the specter of having so much debt upon graduation and being underemployed upon graduation. What I do think that we'll see is the latter part of what you were saying, which is probably more dollars going towards financial aid. So if we're saying 2/3 of students are receiving some sort of financial aid for school, I wouldn't be surprised if those numbers and those percentages continue to tick up rather than a rollback of dollars in raw sticker costs.
I tell you, Rob, it's been really delightful to find a service like yours, because this is a question that, you know, I, in doing financial planning with a lot of my clients who have the means and some not as much, they talk about, what do you do when you have a bright student, but there's 3 kids in the family, you know, mom and dad just simply can't afford $250,000 at an A school for all 3 children. I mean, that's almost like a luxury home here in California. If you were to boil it down, let's say you were counseling parents who have a bright student graduating, what would be the steps in the process in pursuing an education? To me, it seems like it's very important to look at what the job prospects are, because you don't want to pursue a degree where there's no prospects for any employment once you get out. That would be important in addition to the cost. But take our listeners through this step. If you were advising or counseling a parent and a student, what steps and how would you begin?
Number one, for students that are gifted academically and that we know can survive in some of the best schools in the country, and if they have multiple kids at home and they're just nervous about paying for college, my first bit of advice would be to never curtail the list of consideration early on. So we should sail through looking at many different schools, not looking at sticker cost at first. We must think about fit, academic, campus culture. Those things are going to be what students and parents need to focus on. I can see myself in this community, whether it's, you know, Claremont McKenna or Vassar or Brigham Young University. Let's look to see where we're going to be happy and engaged in the classroom and we're going to be, you know, excel in that community. But then thinking, and I do agree with you, the next step is thinking about what's going to happen to me as a student. What are the outside of the classroom opportunities that I can get that are going to be directly related to my academic work and a career afterwards? And that can be formal internship programs, cooperative experiences. The buzzword over the last couple of years has been experiential learning, the idea of learning by doing, but something that's tethered to what you're learning in the classroom that has an outside of the classroom experience, usually in your home city or hometown. And those things make for, and I can use Northeastern University as an example, they have a full year co-op program up there. You know, their students graduate, although in 5 years, as some of the, because they're doing this one co-op outside of the classroom for an entire year of study or year of experiential work, they become some of the most employable upon graduation because of that initiative. My second point is for students and parents to be vigilant in asking about what's going to happen to me through a career resource lens, through that experiential lens. And then third, what are the real financial aid metrics? I mean, we have this, my job at Princeton Review, one of our hats here, is to think about what the real cost of college is going to be. What is the average grant that I'm going to get, the free money that I'll have to pay back? What is the average loan debt that students are going to graduate with in 4 years after this school? I have that data. I've done that homework, you know, and that homework is for students and parents listening to us to access. I mean, it's here. And those are the 3 buckets that I would focus on.
As we close, Rob, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work that you do at Princeton Review and also the book that you published on the 200 Best Colleges, how could they do so, please?
Definitely our website is the most inclusive place to go, which is PrincetonReview.com. And then the book that we've been talking about called Colleges That Pay You Back, certainly available on the website, any major bookstore or online bookseller. But the website has the lion's share of everything that we talked to today, from testing to admission to financial aid.
Well, listen, Rob, I want to thank you for coming on the program. It's really nice to see organizations like yours, because I think, you know, this is a big question. As you mentioned, you get asked, and I get asked when doing planning with my clients for their children's education. Hey, you know, what's the cost of college? What kind of aid packages are out there? What are the prospects for jobs? Is it really worth the extra, you know, paying twice as much for that private education in terms of the benefits after you get out of college? And you guys have gone a long way to answer a lot of those questions. Rob, once again, thanks for joining us on the program.
I thank you so much, Jim. Thanks for inviting me. I hope to be back soon.
Yeah, no, it's sort of interesting. I do miss the academic environment, Jim. It's really interesting because I spent almost 12 years in college myself, and I'd love to go back into philosophy classes and just wreak havoc because, you know, philosophy or political classes, because I don't need a grade. You know, we do that. But when you look at the top 20, you know, the A schools, you still got Harvard and Stanford and MIT in those. But what's really good to know is you can get a good quality education at the B schools as well.
Yeah, I mean, they do have a list, top 13, some of those B schools. And it's surprising because, you know, obviously the education is much, much cheaper. Everything from Georgia Institute of Technology and several schools, like I know for business, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And then here in California, you have UCLA, you have UC Santa Barbara, UC Berkeley. So there are a lot of those B schools, public schools, that are right up there as well. And of course, depending on your profession, as we discussed in the case study today, it just didn't make a lot of sense for somebody that was going to become a teacher at $40,000 a year to spend $200,000 for an education. Anyway, that concludes this week's program. We're going to be doing a few more programs on education, hopefully help you, the parent, or you, the student listening, find that right college and that right program, and hopefully get a good college education with a job waiting for you when you graduate. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.